This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. With the long Thanksgiving weekend behind us, provided, of course, you were able to take a long weekend, we want to spend the hour today talking about work, particularly work and the pandemic. Now, later in the hour, we'll focus on working women. We'll take your calls then at 1-800-423-8255. But let's start with the question of childcare during this pandemic and what that means for work. WBUR's Kathleen McNerney has been reporting on it, and she joins us now. Kathleen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So we all remember when childcare centers in Massachusetts closed down in March. How many are open again now, Kathleen?
So according to the latest data from the state, about 81% of the licensed providers have reopened as of November 6th. Nearly 5% have closed completely. But what's really interesting is that according to a state survey, enrollments are only taking up about 66% of available slots, and only about 10% of kids who are enrolled are not attending. So that means that out of all the seats that are available on a given day, there's only a little more than half of kids actually taking up those seats. We'll expect to get more details from the state next week at their next board meeting.
So there's actually excess capacity right now.
Yeah. And it's not totally clear yet what's driving that. I think a lot of people have guesses, so I'm looking forward to hearing some more.
Okay, so for that 81% that have reopened, Kathleen, I want to ask both, what precautions have they taken and have those precautions worked?
Yeah, like many of us, things are different. There are daily health screenings. Everyone over the age of 2 is basically wearing masks. There's increased disinfection, no shared toys, no toys that can't be easily sanitized. So kids can bring in a Levy, for instance, but there's no classroom teddy bears. Parents are no longer allowed inside. And class sizes are limited according to the square footage. And I think all of those, as well as encouraging social distancing as much as you can with little ones, all of those seem to be working. I think we're not really seeing massive numbers of cases, but they have been increasing recently along, with the community numbers that have been increasing. The most recent reports that I looked at from the state showed that roughly 540 children and 560 staff had tested positive for the coronavirus at some point since late August. But I looked back at the weekly reports, and what you can see is those total numbers are twice as high as what they were at the beginning of November. So it is increasing.
So you have been really looking closely at this, and you looked at the case of Nurturee, which operates 6 centers. It supports about 130 family child care providers in Greater Boston. Tell us what you found there.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think in the fact that they're not that unique, they had been catching any potential cases with the health screen. So if a kid had a sore throat and a cough, they had to go home. If they had a fever, they went home. But that changed in October as rates in Greater Boston were on the rise. I spoke with Laura Peril, who I'm sure you remember. She's CEO of Nurturee. She was also the former Boston school superintendent. And she really pegs it to 2 days back-to-back in October when her phone started ringing and she had 3 cases connected to 3 centers. 2 teachers, a parent, they had no interconnectedness between them. They were completely isolated from one another. And as a result, she had to close one of those locations for 3 weeks. Here's what she said.
That's really when we felt that this was a sign of things to come and we needed more testing support and a better testing solution.
So what about that, Kathleen? Are there these testing solutions out there? I mean, we are hearing the need for more testing and better testing options from pretty much every corner of the economy in the Commonwealth.
I know. And I think especially people are feeling it now with the Thanksgiving holiday upon us. There's more demand for testing and there are long wait lines, as we've been seeing. There are 2 things that are really interesting that are happening. One is that Peril herself created a partnership with a Roslindale testing site where anybody who works at Nurturee or a family that's enrolled there can get priority when they come up to test. They're not skipping the line, so to speak, but the The center is going to get them in as soon as possible so that hopefully if there is a case or a suspected case, it's less disruptive for the family. And Peril thinks that could be really easily scaled up. It's really just a matter of saying, hey, childcare workers are first responders, just like an EMT or a firefighter. So let's make sure that we can get them a spot if they call in and get them tested. The other is this pilot program by the nonprofit Neighborhood Villages. They're using a technique called pooled testing. Now, this is a technique that is being used in colleges, in private schools, and even more resource districts like Wellesley Public Schools. Basically what they do, instead of running just one individual test for say 20 samples, they pool them all together and they run a batch of 20 tests once. And it works really, really well when rates are low because most of the tests are coming back negative. So it's a very efficient way to kind of run through a bunch of negative tests rather than testing mm-hmm. them individually. Once it gets higher, it's a little, it's not as efficient. But basically what they are going to be doing is at these seven organizations that have childcare and after school care, they're going to be testing about 500 workers every week. They're doing a baseline test this week. And then they're going to do surveillance testing once a week using this pooled method. And it really comes out to just like $10 or $13 per test per staff member. And it's if a pool comes back, if one of those batches comes back positive, they go back and test again. So a lot of places are seeing this as a way to kind of efficiently keep things running, particularly when rates are low.
So Kathleen, we've got about a minute left. I appreciate you letting me tell our listeners that you've had your own experience as you've been reporting on this week. Can you tell us about that and whether these kinds of testing solutions would make a difference for you as a working mom?
Yeah, I had to laugh because my son just came down with the sniffles yesterday. And of course, now I'm congested. And so, we had to take precautions. And I think it's just a cold. I have no idea how he got it because we're sanitizing everything. But it happens. But we're finding that we can't get any tests. I can't get him or myself tested until Wednesday because everything's booked up. And the results aren't going to come back till Friday. So it just makes me think a lot about how we're fortunate. My partner and I can both work from home and manage the chaos of having these two vibrant kids here, but a lot of people can't. And it's putting them in a really, really tough position where you're actually losing work days and wages. And that has ripple effects.
Well, Kathleen, we're going to continue to follow you as you follow this story. Thanks for joining us today. That's Kathleen McNerney, editor of WBUR's Edify.
Thank you.
So we know the pandemic is having disproportionate impact on workers by gender. And later in the hour, we'll take your call on the experiences of working women. That number is 800-423-8255. We want right now, though, to take a look at what the research tells us about how the pandemic has affected families more broadly. Boston College research professor Brad Harrington joins us now. He's the executive director of the Boston College Center for Work and Family. Professor Harrington, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's nice to speak with you again.
So I know you heard that conversation I just had with Kathleen McNerney. Yes. What does the research show in terms of the burden of childcare on families during this pandemic?
Well, for businesses, what's never been more clear is how important childcare and school are to allowing organizations to operate effectively. Now that a lot of people are out of school, and I'm surprised that there's overcapacity in daycare centers because that's not been what we've been hearing from our employers. But if that's the case, the number of people at home is really putting an undue burden on women, which might not come as a big surprise. In September of 2020, about four times more women than men dropped out of the workforce. And if you look at the numbers, there's over a million women not in the workforce right now. And that's probably mostly explainable to the fact that, they're taking on the responsibilities at home for COVID. And I think part of it is caregiving in the traditional sense we think of it, but the other part of it is homeschooling, which is that's a new yeah. and additional burden which women are taking on. And the stats we're seeing there is that women are overwhelmingly doing more than men in terms of tutoring and homeschooling.
So you just sort of laid out the equity issues within families where there are two parents or two adults and where the burden of responsibility mm-hmm. is. I think you've looked at some research on the role of men in families. I think we're assuming either two male households or a two parent household. How has that changed over time? And are we moving further forward or rolling back during COVID?
Yeah, well, we've been studying the experience of working dads for about 10 years, Tiziana. And, you know, in general, our experience has been that the trend has been in the right direction, where fathers are in two career couples. Their tendency to take on more and more responsibility on the home front has increased, albeit somewhat slowly, but it has increased over the last 10 years. And where the most recent study we did was actually on parental leave. But in that research, we were able to ask men, you know, how are they doing in terms of, you know, achieving parity with their spouse or partner on the caregiving front? And about 75% of the fathers and mothers said that the expectation is that men and women should do equal amounts on the caregiving front, which is very positive. So you got 3/4 of the dads saying it should be equal. But when we asked how is it being split as of now, and this was before COVID, that dropped down to about 43%. So about 1/3 of the fathers have good intentions to share caregiving equally, but they don't always fill up, kind of live up to their expectations when it comes to, reality on the ground. And I think that's even been exacerbated more by COVID. So the trend that we were seeing moving in a very positive direction toward greater gender equality in the home up until the pandemic hit 9 months ago, we're now seeing reversed. And there is a lot of fear that the repercussions of that on women's careers and women's advancement and even women staying in the workforce are really being felt.
So I want to acknowledge for our listeners, Brad, we're hearing your mic move around a little bit. So listeners, if you hear that, I think that's just a mic issue. Brad, I want to ask about how employers are thinking about single parents during this pandemic. Obviously, as you talked about children schooling from home, you're hearing from employers a lack of access to childcare. What about in a single parent household?
You know, sympathy might be the right word for single parents at this point. I mean, you can look at dual career couples and say, okay, it's a burden on everyone, but if they're able to work flexibly and work from home and that kind of thing, obviously they're in a much better situation than people who are essential workers. So then you have dual career couples where one or both of them are in essential jobs and they don't really have the luxury to be able to stay at home. They have to get into the work. And so they have to find ways through their extended networks or through taking turns to be able to fulfill their on-site job responsibilities. But for single parents, it's just hard for me to fathom, and I haven't got a lot of research to back this up other than anecdotal, but it's really hard for me to fathom how single parents are doing it right now, especially those who are expected to be into the workplace. The only thing I can imagine is some of the more generous, more progressive companies are able to give them more flexible schedules, so they might be able to work themselves around their children's schedules. They may be given additional paid time off if they're very fortunate. And I'm sure a lot of single parents are depending on an extended network they have established either with extended family or with friends and neighbors, because as bad as the situation is for dual career couples, it's way worse for people who don't have a partner that they can count on at this time.
Brad, at this point, we've been talking really about the worker. What do we know about the cost to employers of the burdens that these workers are carrying, of women dropping out of the workforce, of the challenges of schooling at home, the challenges of single parenting?
Yeah, on a macro level, I really don't know what the costs are. I'm sure there are people, you know, economists that are estimating it, and I can tell you they are going to be huge. What we hear more from our individual employers is that they've been, especially the ones where they have so-called knowledge workers, where people don't have to show up at the office every day, but they can do most of their work remotely. And the organizations that we work with are a lot of people in knowledge industries and professional services, accounting, high tech, pharmaceuticals, and so forth. For those, you know, the picture is much brighter than you might expect. A lot of the organizations not only haven't seen a drop off in productivity, but obviously they've seen sort of an uptick from employees in terms of their sense of satisfaction being able to have the benefit of working from home. So that's been positive. And we're seeing some really major employers say, you know, well, we're not going to come back until June or July this summer. And, you know, some of the people may never come back. It may be, and I don't mean by that they're going to be laid off, but rather they're going to be able to work differently. And so they're going to be able to work remotely on perhaps a full-time basis. And you're even seeing small experiments where young people who had expensive apartments in Boston and New York and other places are sort of giving up their apartments and moving back home or moving to a lower cost of living area to see whether or not they could continue to get their job done working remotely. So I think the cost overall, I really don't have a good handle on, but I think, especially in the knowledge worker space, I think it's been less of a hit than people expect.
We're talking to Professor Brad Harrington of Boston College's Center for Work and Family. You wrote a piece in LinkedIn recently calling on fathers and men to step up in this crisis. What do you want to see them do?
More. the truth of the matter, you asked about, you know, women's situation. I mean, you've got more than, you know, 62% of college graduates and people graduating with master's degrees are women. So if you look at the situation these days, the labor market, women make up three fifths of the labor market right now. And they're the ones that are coming out more highly educated, better grades, better GPAs, and their starting salaries are better than men in many instances. And so we really are in a situation, you know, despite the biological differences, where men and women are oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes contributing the same or very similar amounts to the family income. And they're also, you know, both in very fulfilling and demanding careers. So I think one of the things that's happened is, you know, one thing that's been observed fairly frequently is that, you know, for men to say, I'm on a Zoom call and suddenly my kids run through the room or something, that's seen as not acceptable. And so men may be regressing back to a pattern where they're expecting their wife to make the accommodations and make the compromises in order to keep them looking as a full-time, committed, dedicated worker with no distractions. You know, men generally, and fathers that we've studied specifically, have a tendency to be more susceptible to cultural cues that they get from their manager or their coworkers about what does an ideal worker look like. And so men may be more susceptible to that. And as a result of that, I think they may be sort of saying, well, I need to look like a perfect worker, but my wife can make compromises and trade-offs. And so they're not stepping up to the degree that they need to be right now. And that's a problem not only, you know, on a micro level for men and their spouse, it's also a problem for organizations as this pipeline of women starts to get truncated because they're having to cut back.
And just briefly before I let you go,
sure.
Is there research that plays this out for same-sex couples?
Very little. The research, certainly not during COVID, I haven't seen anything yet, Tiziana. The research on how same-sex couples balance work-family issues is interesting. And there's one positive note there for sure. And that is because they are of the same gender, there's no sort of built-in expectation that I'm the man, you're the woman, therefore you will do this and I will do that. With same-sex couples, those roles have to be navigated and they have to be designed. And so what happens then is there are conversations that occur between people in same-sex couples, and there are very few assumptions about who's going to do what. And those conversations usually yield a better end result in terms of balancing work and family. So both partners in a situation where they said, we've discussed this and we've decided mutually what was the right solution for us.
All right, Brad Harrington is a Boston College research professor and the executive director of the Boston College Center for Work and Family. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Good to talk to you again, Tiziana.
We are spending the hour today talking about work and the pandemic, including your experiences. And for the rest of the hour, we are going to focus on women, especially since women have been leaving the workforce in droves since the pandemic started. We want to hear from you. Are you a working woman, a woman with a family? Tell us what it's been like for you. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, one thing that we have learned from this pandemic is that it exacerbates what's already broken, especially when it comes to inequalities. And that is true for women's experiences. Discrimination, work-family balance, challenges have been around a long time. Just ask former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift. When she became acting governor in 2001 after Paul Cellucci was appointed U.S. ambassador to Canada, she was pregnant with twins. She became the first sitting governor in U.S. history to give birth 1 month into her term. Governor Swift joins us now. Governor Swift, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I am thrilled to be here with you today.
Great to have you. And we are talking about this set of issues for working women that has been laid in stark relief by the pandemic, for sure, but obviously already there. This is an issue that's personal to you. What were the biggest barriers for you as one of the nation's first real governor moms?
So I think that the issue for all working moms, but certainly for me in a public role, is that you get asked questions and held to a different standard than many of your male peers. And so oftentimes I did what many people call covering, because there is this underlying assumption that many voters didn't acknowledge they felt, but you knew it was there, that they doubted your ability to do the job. You would sort of hide your responsibilities or your role as a mom because you didn't want people to doubt your commitment to the job. And unfortunately, that makes it really hard to start to change the norms in the workplace if you're not acknowledging the importance of both roles that you play.
So you just talked about this different standard. I heard a podcast interview with you when you talked about the fact that you were asked about your ability to be a working mother even before you had kids, an experience that I admit is also familiar to me in my past life. This is the kind of thing that weighs on women and their perceptions of what they can achieve, what they'll be, have the runway cleared for them. You have called that the confidence gap. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it starts to weigh on you, right? Like you start to doubt your own ability. It really challenges you to be an authentic leader. I think the good news is that there's lots of emerging research, though, of ways to get around it. And as the mother of three daughters, I am really committed to making sure it's better for the women who come behind me. And so one of the things that we've learned both in boards, but also in leadership situations, is that when there's more than one woman in a leadership position, there is a safety aspect there, and you're able to start changing some of those norms. And in several of my leadership positions, when I led as a CEO of an online curriculum company, Middlebury Interactive Languages, and today at LearnLaunch, I have majority female run organizations, and we actually get to take advantage. We have a dearth of labor because young women want to come work for us. They want to have role models who are showing how you can successfully combine work and family. So I think there can be a positive outcome to these stories, and that's what we're trying to show.
Governor Swift, let's go to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. We have Emily on the line from Somerville. Emily, you're on with Governor Jane Swift.
Hi. I have found myself in this really strange position of having to sort of pivoted to a new career about a year before all of this started. I actually went back to nursing school as a single mother and was about to embark on this career as a nurse. And then all of this hit, and I had another child, and now I'm in this strange position where I'm equipped to really be helpful, but I also have these two children at home, and my partner is working full-time. And so much has fallen on me childcare-wise that I find myself really torn. Also now afraid that this new career that I was so excited to be starting isn't going to go anywhere because they're going to look at my resume and say, well, where were you during these years? And why weren't you working through a pandemic? Yeah. I feel like I'm being torn in all of these different directions.
Thanks for sharing your story with us, Emily. Yeah, go ahead, Governor Swift, jump in.
Yeah, and please call me Jane. I embrace the title because I'm proud of what I achieved, but I also like for people to recognize me in the role I'm in now. And here's what I would say. I think these gaps in resumes because of child rearing is another issue that so many of my peers face, and Emily, I think she said was her name, really articulated so many of the challenges. So I think a couple of things, single parents, which the Boston College professor talked about earlier, can be a particularly difficult situation, and having to figure out how you really take and balance your own career aspirations with your need to also take care of your own children is a very difficult internal struggle. And I think one of the things that I hope has changed over the last 22 years since I had my first child is that women are being more supportive of each other and the choices that we make. And so one of the things, Emily, that I hope is that this is a shared experience, and many women and many men are going through it. And so there will be employment folks on the other side of the interview table who, my hope is, female and male, will recognize, and you can be open about that experience. But I recognize that it takes confidence to acknowledge the choice that you made and the challenge that you faced.
All right. I'd like to bring some additional voices in alongside you now, Governor Swift. I'm glad that you're going to stay with us for the rest of the hour. Oops, sorry, Jane. listeners, we continue to want to hear your stories. Are you a working woman or a woman with a family? What are your biggest pressure points? Or maybe you're a father or a grandparent who has had to take on new responsibilities due to this pandemic. 800-423-8255. We're going to welcome now Kim Borman, Executive Director of the Boston's Women Workforce Council, a public-private partnership between Boston and the city's business community, which works to close the gender wage gaps in Boston, and Rosario Ubiera Minaya, the Executive Director of Amplify Latinx, which works to build Latinx economic and political power in Massachusetts. Kim, Rosario, welcome to this conversation.
Thank you so much, Tiziana.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to join.
So, Rosario, let me turn to you for a minute. You are a working mom. You have two kids in middle school and high school. How have you been handling the juggle over the last several months?
It has been very stressful. It's just been hard to really balance everything that has been thrown on my plate. Again, I'm working from home. I'm also balancing, having my daughter studying high school in the middle of a pandemic, and all the stress that come with that as well. And it's just been very, very stressful and overwhelming.
Kim, from the start of the pandemic, the job losses among women have been the result of both the collapse of female-dominated industries like hospitality, education, entertainment, but women are also choosing to drop out of the workforce entirely. 800,000 out of 1.1 million people between August and September were women. And we've been hearing, we just heard about strains from Rosario, we've been hearing the whole show about these strains. What else do we need to understand is going on?
Well, there's a couple things going on. One is something that the governor spoke about, is that most of this isn't new. I mean, it's just been aggravated by what's by the pandemic. But for so long, we've been talking about the needs that businesses, organizations, employers need to look at, which is of women, which is the flexibility and the idea that perhaps offering on-site childcare, backup childcare services, looking at paid family leave, new ways of evaluating your performance. It's not how many hours you put into a timesheet, but it's your outcome. These are all things that have been discussed, I'd say, for 30 years, but now they seem to be taking on much more urgency from the organizations that we speak with, and perhaps, believe it or not, there could be a silver lining coming out of all of this.
You know, Jane, I'm thinking about these resources that Kim was just talking about, the changes that we could make to give people greater flexibility. You know, you weren't without controversy when you were breaking through the barriers as lieutenant governor and then governor. During a time when your child was sick, as the lieutenant governor, you took a helicopter ride home from state troopers. You got some babysitting support from staffers. The public rebukes, they were fierce and they were widespread. Had some of these other supports been in place, Do you think you would have made different choices then? And how do you look at that time now?
So I look at it in a variety of ways. You know, the helicopter issue, I think, is one that I wasn't supposed to say this then, but is particularly interesting because that wasn't found. There are a lot of governors who have taken helicopters for similar reasons, but it was really touching on the work family issues that so many people were stressed about. And what I have often told people privately is I shouldn't have gone to work that day. The mistake I made was my child was sick. My husband was at the emergency room a couple hundred miles away, but I was so afraid to acknowledge with all the spotlight on me, you know, that I had to take a day off because my child was sick, because so many people had talked about how, you know, I couldn't do it. And, you know, you shouldn't be so selfish and you shouldn't try to have it all. And I felt so much pressure to sort of hold up the responsibility for all these young women and my peers who I knew could do great things and were raising families, that the mistake was not taking a day off to take care of myself and my family. And so that's one of the things I talk a lot to young women about. But in terms of the silver lining, I have women that work for me now with young children. And we also are doing these online workshops for teachers across Massachusetts. And maybe not for them, but for me, the best days are when they have a 1 or 2 year old crawling all over them in the middle of a live workshop or the middle of a meeting, because I can give grace and tell them it's fine. The world isn't going to end if we stop something for 5 minutes. One of our experts was in the middle of something and their 13 year old needed them. And we just stopped. And I was able to say, this is fine. You know, moms need the opportunity to step away. We could go 10 minutes later in the workshop. Somebody else can step in, and being able to be in a position of power where I can grant the flexibility to the folks who work for me that frankly wasn't available to me. Just that's the best part of this experience for me. And I have been able to derive so much value from their life experiences and the work we're doing that I get to also see the benefit of employing working mothers.
So let's go to the phones again, and then I want to turn back to Rosario. We've got Lena on the line from Andover. Lena, go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you so much for discussing this important topic. And I would like to say that, first of all, I'm very fortunate that I still have my job and I work in biotechnology. That means I have to go to work every day. We never closed for COVID because, as you know, cancer doesn't wait for COVID to end. And at the same time, I have a son who is 10 years old right now, and he actually goes to school twice a day. And it's actually very difficult for me to make sure I go to work every day, because 3 days out of those 5, he's at home. And my husband is also full-time employer. So, So what I'm trying to say is that why our public schools can't safely open like private schools did to provide in-person learning. I do understand all the concerns, but at the same time, it's almost impossible to keep a 10-year-old child on its own. So in my case, I'm actually lucky because I was able to move my mom, so he stays with my grandmother. But at the same time, I know
not everyone has that.
Have to quit their jobs because no one is available to stay with the children.
Lena, thank you so much for that call. And Rosario, Lena's talking about her particular case. We also know, you know, I gave that data earlier, 800,000 of the 1.1 million people dropping out of the workforce between August and September were women. Latina women have left the workforce at nearly 3 times the rate of white women, 4 times the rate of African-American women. What institutionally, what structurally, what public policy-wise are we getting wrong that we need to adjust?
Well, it's been mentioned throughout the conversation today that, which is no news, that Black and Latinx communities have collectively faced some of the most damaging economic and health effects of the coronavirus. And the trends that we are seeing will have lasting consequences for both household budgets and the broader economy. We've been hearing that and seeing that data. But in terms of the Latino community, and especially Latinas, we are seeing generations of wealth and the advancement that we collectively have achieved in decades of work disappearing in front of our eyes. We are seeing Latina entrepreneurs losing their businesses, closing businesses in the community. We see, as you mentioned, the Latinx workers leaving the workforce. And you know, Latina workers are heavily represented in occupations that have been affected by COVID shutdowns. Many Latina work in industries that have been hammered by the pandemic. So as we see the overall unemployment rate decreased, the unemployment rate for Latinas have increased. And they've been laid off, and the schools have been, like you have been mentioned too, schools and daycares are closed, and children are sent home. So our childcare and school systems don't meet the needs of the working mothers. We've seen all of these disruptions really affecting disproportionately. Latinas have been hit very, very hard during this process. We are the backbone of our families, and we traditionally have been torn between bettering ourselves and growing professionally and providing for our families to maintaining the more traditionally a stay-at-home mom situation, and always being available for the care of our children and to support our household. So all of that is really affecting disproportionately, like I mentioned, Latinas and the reasons why they're leaving the workforce at this point.
We've been spending this hour talking about work in the pandemic, and we're focused now on working women, whether you're a working mother, a single woman, wherever you are in the workforce. Still with us are our panelists, former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, Kim Borman, who is Executive Director of the Boston Women's Workforce Council, and Rosario Ubiera Minaya, the Executive Director of Amplify Latinx. We want to continue to take your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm going to grab a caller right here. We've got Rachel on the line from Everett. Rachel, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. So I am newer to the workforce. I'm 25. I just recently graduated, and I am a working woman, but I don't have some of the issues around childcare. But I just wanted to say that for people my age who are just breaking into their fields, like I, for example, work in sustainability and higher education, but it's really hard in a couple ways to see some of my colleagues struggle so much and to feel like, oh, I really don't have anything to complain about. All I have to worry about is my husband and myself. But I think it's hard and overwhelming to see people you care about struggle so much. And then it's hard to think as a young person who just got into their career in this new world of working from home, what is this going to look like? For us who just started maybe a job in an office, or I like the word that someone used before, like a knowledge worker, like, are we going to do this forever now? I know someone also said, you know, this might be some people's job is forever working from home.
Rachel, thank you for that. And I'm going to give Kim Borman a chance to respond. Kim, please.
I think, Rachel, that my own feeling is that there will be more choice, and not everybody will work from home, but not everyone will be in an office either. And one thing that is happening is everyone has experienced this at one time. So this will not look like, you know, different on your resume than anybody else's, and you're working through it. So what I would say is what we're hearing from the employers that are part of the 100% Talent Compact, meaning that they sign a pledge with us to make sure that they're going to eliminate any kind of gender wage gap. They are definitely looking at their younger employers and how do they bring them in and how do they train them and how do they make sure that they're getting the same kind of experience that they might get if they were in the office. So what I can tell you from what I'm hearing from our members is that people understand what you're going through and they're working as hard as they can towards it to try to make the experience as best they can, sort of normal.
So, Rosaria, let me turn back to you. What do we need to see from employers and government, let's say over the next 12 months, to ensure that women, working women, both recover from the losses of this pandemic, but don't wind up sort of a permanent extra step behind from the way this pandemic has played out?
Our organization, Amplify Latinx, focuses on leadership representation and really acquiring wealth for the Latinx community in order to advance our community. I believe as a working mom, as a Latina, as a professional woman that has been in the workforce for over 20 years, that's what we need in order to advance our community and really address the underlying issues that we are seeing affecting our community. We really need leadership representation in decision-making positions, but Latinas have been emerging as prominent leaders in corporate positions for a while, but they're also leaving corporate America at an alarming rate. Many Latinas place a significant emphasis on spending time together as a family, something that corporate America understands and values, but doesn't often accommodate well. So we really believe that we really need to focus on acquiring wealth and capital, resources that really support Latinas in either staying in the workforce, opening their own businesses, or opportunities for leadership representation, more decision-making opportunities in C-suite roles, boardrooms across sectors, really getting to that level of decision-making. And that has to be done collectively. And we have to think about policies and advocate for support, not only in the in the legislature, but also, in the private sector as well.
Let's go to Saray, a caller from Newton. Saray, go ahead.
Hi, I'm very interested in listening to your speakers and people who are calling in. I'm chief of surgery at Newton Wellesley Hospital and also a scientist and manage, research program at MGH. And I'm really worried about our woman surgeons, physicians in the front line, as well as our scientists, because they're having to deal with a lot at home, very disruptive care of their children, a lot of stress at home because, they were used to having really either their children in school full time, after school programs, child care at home, nannies. It's all been disrupted, and yet we have to come to work, obviously, and take care of the patients and everything that's needed. But there really hasn't been great accommodation for us and, the surgical residents, everyone. So I'm very concerned.
Thanks for the call, Saray, and for your work at Newton Wellesley. I imagine this is a particularly challenging time to do what you do. Jane, what about the pressure, the unpredictability, the chaos of that while trying to deal with high-pressure, chaotic jobs?
Yeah, I think that is a particular stress. I'd be interested to hear what MGH and Brigham is doing to support those workers. I think that one of the points that Rosaria brought up was a really good one, that often these issues are much more overwhelming around class, and you find that the folks with the least amount of capital to be able to find flexibility and to find solutions are people with less means. So focusing on wealth creation, focusing on small businesses is, outside of a pandemic, generally a great way to address the inequities. Unfortunately, in this crisis, some of the very paths that have inoculated working women from the stresses, like being high achievers in science and in healthcare, or being small business owners, have actually been some of the most heavy burdens and taken some of the brunt of the economic and workforce challenges. And I think that We have not seen nimbleness from our federal government in the response to creating unique supports. And that should be, I hope, one of the things that gets focused on in this next round of supports when Congress and a new administration gets back to work.
Kim, let me just ask you, are there any pivots that the Boston Women's Workforce Council has made as a result of the pandemic, or new things you're focusing on, or places you're placing more emphasis than before?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, and it actually goes to Mass General Brigham. We give something out. It's called the Innovative Initiatives Award. We do this at our Effective Practices Conference, which actually happens to be on Thursday. And usually we ask companies who are our compact signers to apply for something that they have done in three or four categories that have to do with advancing women. And one of the categories this year was supporting women during COVID. And it's interesting. That's the only category that got any applications. And in fact, Mass General Brigham, I don't want to give it away, is going to win one for a program that they did for women doctors in trying to get them into grand rounds internationally because they can't travel. Now, the point to this is they couldn't travel before very much either because they had the commitment of kids at home. And so hopefully this is going to be something that gets translated from not just now during COVID, but to, everyday life, because it's a way that that women need to actually focus their career on more international settings so that they can get promoted. And in fact, it has happened that close to 10 out of the people that have done this program are being promoted this year. So it is working.
So we're at that funny moment where I don't really have enough time for another caller or another question, but we have a touch of time left in the show. So all I'm going to do is flag a call we didn't get to from Mary in Magnolia, Massachusetts. And I want to flag it because what she had wanted to talk to us was about ageism, the challenge for women in their 50s and 60s who are now being displaced and will struggle to find another job. And I just want to note that because it hasn't been part of our conversation today. And it's something that I think is going to be worth its own attention. And maybe we should try to focus on in a future segment here on Radio Boston. I want to take a minute now to thank our guests. We had former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, Kim Borman, who is Executive Director of the Boston Women's Workforce Council, which is a public-private partnership between Boston and the city's business community to work on closing gender wage gaps, and Rosario Ubiera Minaya, the Executive Director of Amplify Latinx, which is launched by the nonprofit Latina Circle and works to build Latinx economic and political power in Massachusetts. Thanks to all three of you for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening and calling in today. That's our show. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tune in tomorrow for more Radio Boston.